is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. So much on my plate today. First of all, thank you to Shano and Danielle, or Danielle and Shano, as the case may be, for filling in for me on Thursday and Friday. Louise and I were in New York. We had business all day Thursday, and Friday was the Talkers Convention, and which was fine. It's a great thing. And, hanging out with a whole bunch of other talk show hosts, which means, I saw Alan Colmes there, but I think everybody else was a conservative. Ouch. Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. Well, anyway, so a lot of stuff here for today that I wanted to talk with you about. And Hillary Clinton announced her candidacy on Sunday, was it? Saturday. My week has been. My weekend was rather disjointed. I was going to write all weekend, and because I'm behind on a couple of writing projects, and our boat took down the dock, and it had some kind of short in it, and Louise and I spent all day Saturday in a boat with three cats and a dog in 90-degree weather with the sun out, and it was like over 100 degrees in the boat. We had no air conditioning, and all the windows open, and fans on, and with the panel open and trying to trace wires and, with ohmmeters and stuff and trying to figure it out. I finally, around 9 or 10 o'clock at night Saturday, gave up. I couldn't figure the damn thing out. I'm not a marine electrician. I mean, I know electronics. I'm an old ham radio operator, but I just couldn't figure this one out. So a friend who's also a marine contractor came down and all day Sunday. He and I did it. We ended up pulling 60 wires out of the control panel and toning every single one of them one at a time, basically all the wires on the boat, all the common lines on the boat, trying to find, because we have a leakage between common and ground. It's called a ground fault. And we found a big one, which was a failed heater element in a water heater. But it's still happening. It's Louise's home right now, and it's tripping the circuit breaker every hour or so. So we've got some sort of intermittent problem. So, and it tripped it every hour all night long. And so every hour all night long, or every 2 hours, because it would take me an hour to figure out that it had happened, because the room would start getting hot. I would have to get up, get dressed, walk outside to the dock, and reset the circuit breaker, and then get back and try to get to bed. So if I seem a little goofy. Might have something to do with the fact that I was up at 1, I was up at 3, I was up at 4:45, I was up at 6, I was, and anyway, it's been a long weekend. And, Mercury went direct on Thursday of last week, so maybe all this happened on Thursday. Well, actually, this all started happening on Tuesday of last week, but we had an isolation transformer from Tuesday until Friday, so we were separated from the dock, so we weren't blowing any breakers. But then another boat came in, and they needed a transient, and so they needed to put the isolation transformer on that. And it's not my transformer. It's the club's transformer. And so I lost the transformer, and that's when everything went downhill. And that was first thing Saturday morning. So anyway, not to complain and not asking for sympathy, but just an FYI. So if I seem a little goofy, my apologies. Okay, I wanted to talk about Hillary Clinton. I wanted to talk about this woman who has been passing as black, Rachel Dolezal, I think her name is, Dolezal, out in California, out in Washington State. And this is kind of complex. Actually, this is quite complex. I mean, it might be something as simple as somebody with borderline personality disorder, which is where a person doesn't really have a strong sense of self, bonding with her adopted African-American brothers and then going to Howard University and bonding. And, who knows? I mean, it could be just it's probably in fact, in all probability, this is some sort of a psychological thing. But it raises a whole lot of really interesting questions. typically, I mean, up until relatively recently, up until my lifetime, if black people tried to pass as white and were caught, depending on the state, they could be put in prison. You know, if the Klan was around, they could be put to death, and were frequently. During the era of slavery, when that happened, I mean, Thomas Jefferson married off two of his daughters with Sally Hemings as white to white New York white businessmen and got them out. But had they been busted, those women's fates would have been terrible. So there is this hierarchy, this you know, that starts with male white power, and then there's female white power, and then there's male black power, and then there's female black power, and that's the descending order. And then you can insert kind of in the middle in those places, you know, gay power and whatnot. You know, where gay, you know, and in fact, there's a pecking order there, too. You know, male trans, female trans, male men, gay men, gay women, all are viewed differently. But why would somebody give up white privilege unless it was to... You know, I don't know. I'd like to have a conversation. And as a white male, I'm not probably the best person to understand this. My own personal experience. I mentioned back when we were having a debate about gay marriage 6-8 months ago, that when I was a teenager, I experimented with gay sex, with having sex with a man, and having a relationship with a man, in fact, and. The thing that attracted me, first of all, I was just curious, and I discovered, you know, this is something I don't really like. I guess I'm straight. And I figured that out fairly quickly. But the thing that I really wanted was that sense of community that I saw in the gay community in East Lansing. And in fact, I went to several of the MSU gay liberation meetings. I was the acting vice president for one meeting. So, you know, am I like Rachel? I don't know, you know. But, you know, that was relatively short-lived, and I just decided, or I just realized, you know, hey, I'm really a straight guy, and I'm not bisexual, and I can't pretend I am. It doesn't work. And, you know, so I can kind of understand wanting to be part of a minority group where there's a really tight sense of community. Louise was out walking the dog this morning, and we live down on the waterfront here in D.C., and it's a neighborhood that's going through massive, rapid gentrification. And there was a black woman who was walking her dog in the park, and she and Louise got to talking, and this woman said, this used to be an all-black area, and it was a really tight community. And she said, if you left something on the stove cooking and you went to the store and you forgot to turn off the stove, you know, everybody left their doors open and your neighbor would come over and turn off your stove. I mean, it was a really tight community. And now that, you know, gentrification is happening and the neighborhood is about 50-50 white and black and it's moving toward more and more white, and the black folks who are living down on the waterfront are moving more and more toward middle class and upper middle class. She said that community is just blown to hell. So there's issues of community. There's issues of that. I also have to talk about TPP. I want to share with you the names of the 38 Democrats who voted to betray us on this issue, because it's going to be voted on tomorrow. And also the Koch brothers are teaming up with Shelley Adelson. I mean, it's an amazing day. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So much to talk about, so little time. But we will. We will. We are here. We will carry on. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And let's see here. Charles in Conway, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Charles, you want to take advantage of Anything Goes Summer and talk about health insurance?
Yes, I would like to know if anyone has done the math to try to figure out how much it costs the American public for health insurance and compare that to how much it would cost our government to pay that.
You mean if we had single payer, if everybody had Medicare?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any one individual or group that's done the math, although I'm guessing that probably there are quite a few, and you can find it online without great difficulty. But what I do know and can say without equivocation is that those countries that actually have single payer healthcare systems like Canada, or and I'm talking developed countries, many of the European countries, pay, you know, the national what is paid out of the national coffers is about half of what we pay for healthcare in the United States by running it all through most of it through for-profit insurance companies. It's about half, and in most of those countries, hospitals have to be not-for-profit. You know, many medical providers are not-for-profit. Drug prices are regulated, and which is why we pay the highest prices for drugs in the world as well. And so I think it would be reasonable to say that if, A, you could renegotiate Medicare Part D so that Medicare can actually negotiate for drug prices so they don't have to pay, you know, a dollar a piece for aspirins, and, B, we were to simply allow everybody in America to enroll in Medicare, that we would have a healthcare system that costs about half of what it costs right now. Does that make sense, Charles?
Yes.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's just looking at other countries, right, and seeing what they're doing. Some of the other things. This Rachel Dolezal has, by the way, she just resigned from the NAACP. There's also a male-female issue around this, which I find interesting. And, oh, by the way, this is Free Speech TV has not yet hit their fundraising goals for this fundraising cycle. And so those of you watching on Free Speech TV, first of all, if you're listening at one of our Pacifica stations, please support them. You know, support however you're getting the show, right? I mean, you know, call your Pacifica station or independent local FM station, whatever it may be. Please support them. But Free Speech, we will be talking about Free Speech TV and fundraising at the bottom of the hour. So the issues around Rachel Dolezal. There are some people who are trying to draw comparisons between that and Bruce Jenner, right? And saying, well, Bruce Jenner is trans now, and Rachel is trans black. I have a concern about that. But on the other hand, I mean, race is a social construct, right? It is. There's not a gene for race, although there are individual genes for skin color and eye color and hair color and things, but there's not one gene for race. So it very much is a social construct, and in that context, well, we'll continue the conversation. This is 20 minutes past the hour. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I want to lay a couple of other things on the table with regard to this. First of all, a clip from Hillary Clinton. Let's just start with clip number one. That, you know, she was inspired by FDR. Here's from Hillary Clinton's speech on Saturday.
President Roosevelt's four freedoms are a testament to our nation's unmatched aspirations and a reminder of our unfinished work at home and abroad. His legacy lifted up a nation and inspired presidents who followed. One is the man I served as Secretary of State, Barack Obama. And another is my husband, Bill Clinton.
So, you know, it's kind of her introduction. If I'm just curious what you thought of it. You know, I thought it was a pretty good speech. Short on specifics, but long on good Democratic themes. She didn't talk about trade, but since then she has come out and said you should support Nancy Pelosi. Now, with regard to the TPP, Nancy Pelosi is now saying, and this is curious, she said, the prospects for passage of Fast Track will greatly increase with the passage of a robust highway bill, which is a fancy way of saying, okay, Republicans, give us something we want, we'll give you your Fast Track. Which says to me that this is not a matter of principle for Nancy Pelosi. So I think it's time for us to seriously think about, you know, please call your member of your the House of Representatives today and say no Fast Track, because it's going to be up for vote again tomorrow. So back to Rachel Dolezal. I mentioned during the break on our Free Speech TV feed that there was a time when I got very, very close to the gay community when I was a teenager in back in Michigan, and tried essentially being gay, and even showed up at MSU gay liberation meetings and stood in as vice president in one meeting. He wasn't there, so I took the role. It's kind of a parlimentary thing. But it wasn't me. I figured that out quite quickly, and I'm straight. I'm not bisexual. I'm straight, and so here we are. But what appealed to me was not the idea of being gay, but that there was such solidarity in the gay community at that time. I mean, I'm assuming there still is. That being part of a subculture, an oppressed subculture, there's this extraordinary sense of solidarity. Did I tell the story about Louise during the break? Yeah, okay. Louise was telling me, I'm going to repeat this story. Louise was walking her dog this morning, and our new dog, and in the park, and there was a black woman that she met there who was walking her dog, and this woman was telling her how the neighborhood used to be 100% black. It's the Southwest waterfront. And I mean, just like 8 years ago. And now that it's being renovated, it's also being gentrified. I mean, the price of apartments or of condos down there has gone from, a couple hundred thousand to a million. I mean, it's amazing. And so the neighborhood is now about 50-50 white-black, and most of the African-Americans who are moving in are upscale, they're middle class or above. And this woman said, it used to be that there's just this incredibly tight community here. If you left a pan on the stove and went to the store and forgot to turn the stove off and your neighbor smelled it, I mean, everybody left their doors unlocked, your neighbor would come over and turn the stove off for you. And she said that just has gone. That sense of community has gone. So was Rachel looking for a sense of community? Louise and I have a relative, a member of our family, who married, she's white, she married an African-American man, lived with him for years and years. He died of a heart attack about 2 years ago. And she's lived in the black community in southeastern Michigan with him for decades. And she still lives in the black community, and she's white. But she perms her hair. She doesn't try to pass herself off as black. But that's her community now, this white relative of mine. So, there's something here. But to put this in the context, I was really educated by Eleanor Burkett. This was in the Sunday Review, June 6th, in the New York Times, What Makes a Woman? And she's talking about Bruce Jenner becoming a woman. And she says, that's all fine and good, but Bruce is not really a woman. He's trans. He's not really a woman. And these are not quotes, these are my paraphrasing, but, he didn't grow up being talked over by boys in school. Boys interrupt girls far more than vice versa. He didn't grow up worried about being raped when he walked through, you know, any neighborhood in the dark. He didn't grow up, you know, freaking out when he first started menstruating. He didn't grow up with the concern of pregnancy. I mean, he just didn't have the experience that an actual woman has. And so he can be a woman, but he's not really a woman. He's trans. And in fact, she points out in the article that Bruce Jenner had, when it was Bruce Jenner, had all the advantages of white male privilege, which got him an athletic scholarship and got him great jobs and got him speaking things. And just, you know, he took full advantage of that white male privilege and now is leveraging that into being a female. So that's that kind of step down. I don't see an easy explanation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And for that reason, I would love to hear what you have to say, people of all races, particularly our African-American viewers. I'm curious. We'll be back. And excuse me while I drink my Tom's Beats beet juice. I made up some beet juice from this Super Beet stuff this morning. So anyhow, we've got a lot on our plate, and I haven't even gotten to the. I will read the final vote results and then pick up your phone calls. If any of these Democrats represent you, you might want to call Congress's switchboard at 202-225-3121 right now and talk to their office. Ashford, these are the guys who voted for the Trade Promotion Authority. TPA, right, which passed last week, and now the enabling legislation, or the let's make up for all the lost jobs legislation, that has to pass, and that vote is going to be tomorrow. But anyhow, these are the ones: Ashford, Barra, Beyer, Blumenauer, Bonamici, Himes, Hinosa, Johnson, E.B. There's three Johnsons. This is E.B. Johnson. Kilmer, Polis, Quigley, Rice, Schrader, Connolly, Cooper, Costa, Quaylar, Davis, Delaney, Delbeny, Farr, Kind, Larson, Meeks, O'Rourke, Peters, Sewell, and Wasserman Schultz. That's interesting. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the DNC, voting for this. All right, let's get to the issue here. Renee in Salinas, California. Hey, Renee, thank you for calling.
Morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Yes, I just wrote some notes to myself, Tom, here. I don't know if I'm mistaking about what Rudyard Kipling's saying about the white man's burden. This is an example of Rachel Dolezal, her name, of the white woman's burden. And as I was writing what you were saying about your particular experiences, I'm not trying to be black. I am black.
Right.
I will, and I'm proud of being black, and I'm speaking for myself, but notwithstanding, I've been speaking with a lot of family members and friends about this issue. I don't take off who and what I am as a black woman for fun and shed my skin as if I was some type of snake.
Right.
Okay, and there's ways of being allies and true allies, not the type of ally who has contempt for whomever they're aligning themselves with.
Or condescension.
Condescension, which more often than not has happened towards African-Americans, the so-called friends really show their behinds,
right,
and sooner or later betray us and have betrayed us. You be yourself. People will see who the true defenders, the true lovers of justice are about. But this issue with her, she's white like me, David Griffin, she's the soul sister, having fun on the so-called, white side or black side, supposedly. And then on top of that, if you observe how, from what I've read about how she then lived in areas where there weren't too many black folks where she could easily pull this stunt off.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel my position is that had she been somewhere where there was a bigger African American base, people would have naturally, that she might have met, who are you? You know, who are your people? Where do your people come from? Are you from at home? Are you from Louisiana? Are you from
Texas? she had a black husband, and she adopted one of her siblings as a black child.
Well, right, but what I've read, she and again, there's a lot to sift through. She divorced that black husband, and being black or being born or being married to whomever doesn't make you an expert.
I agree.
In that particular, you can be just as racist toward that individual.
I agree. Well, and that was.
I think she's demeaning. She was demeaning and has been to the lives of black women who live their lives 24/7, 365 under very trying times and trying circumstances, but still survive and thrive. And she's made a mockery of it. She's made a mockery.
Well, would you say
without fostering.
Renee, would you say that this is another example of white privilege, that, you know, a white person, yeah, that it's a white person can do
white,
this,
white,
a black
white,
person
white,
can't.
You know, white women's privilege too, because next to the white man, the white woman has, in my opinion, she has the second amount of privilege and be able to pull this off.
Yeah.
You know, and then on top of that, and this is another subject matter, that she then kind of ingratiate herself to be a lighter-skinned black woman, which because of the issue of white supremacy, of the lines of demarcation that were falsely created amongst us as black people, that I believe has a stream in here that's very painful to deal with in terms of how people read her and how she was probably given a degree of privilege amongst black folks who feel marginalized anyway to have gotten away with it even more so. And
so,
that's another conversation.
So that having been, if so, those people who thought that she was a light-skinned black person, light-skinned black people are essentially higher in the pecking order within the black community than dark-skinned black people.
With some, and that's something, because if you've had 200 to 300 years of mind control and how can I say this, Tom? Of
indoctrination.
Indoctrination.
Cultural indoctrination.
It is so unconscious, you don't even realize what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then at the same time of her going around, she has an MFA supposedly from Howard. How does she then become an expert in African American history? She's if she was an art expert, I can understand. But then she's going around posturing around the issues of scholarship that people have.
Right.
Done their life work, and it sounds, some of it sounds rather, as they say in the streets, rather whack.
Yeah, yeah, and this is why I said I'm not sure that she's the best example. I mean, it provokes the discussion, but it may just be that this is a woman who has mental issues.
Yes, but the best example for me is John Brown. But see, John Brown laid his life down, and others who did. But John Brown never went around saying that he was a black man.
Right.
He was himself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Well said. Renee, I got to move along. There's a lot of other people who want to get in here, but thank you. That was brilliant. Yvonne in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Yvonne.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Your last caller. Oh, by the way, I love your show.
Thank you.
Your last caller really encapsulated a lot of what I was going to say, but I was a little disappointed towards the end listening to your conversation when you said maybe it was a mental health issue. That smacks, again, of white privilege.
Right.
It is not a mental health condition with this woman. She chose to do this.
Right.
And as your last caller said, she played upon something that is not talked about enough within the black community, light skin, dark skin. And people always put it in the black community as light skin versus dark skin, which is ridiculous. And speaking as a light skinned Negro, I know that that privilege exists.
Right.
It's ridiculous. And I know also, too, as a light skinned black woman, that if I'm called out or asked about my blackness, I get offended. So it's sort of like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah.
So people won't question you, you know, like she said, they won't ask who are your people, where are you from, things that would quickly identify you and identify your credibility, you know, when you're fair skinned, because, you know, we're kind of taught that race is, even within the black community, is this thing we don't talk about. It's the elephant in the room that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
But what really infuriates me with her is that the group that she so wants to identify with, that she so felt that she was a part of, she stole from this group. She stole from us. She stole scarce opportunities that were set aside for black women.
Well, do we know that? Because, you know, she went to Howard University, but a lot of white people do, and it looks like she entered Howard University as a white person. She didn't get a scholarship as a black person, although I may be wrong.
The last thing I read, it was she entered as a black person.
Oh, she did.
On her application.
That's a crime. In that case, she's committed a crime.
I agree with you. My issue with the NAACP, my issue is not her being a part of the NAACP issue. You know as well as anyone else that many people of many creeds and colors have worked with organizations, equality organizations such as this.
Right.
She could have done so much good as herself.
Yep.
The black community has to be one of the most welcoming communities there is.
Yep.
Even now, people within the black community are making excuses for her, willing to forgive something to me that is very unforgivable. That is how open and tolerant we can be to those people we perceive as being friends.
Right. Okay. When she was a kid, she had two brothers, adopted brothers, who were black. And what if that, you know, being the white girl at school as a kid with two black brothers caused her to be ostracized by the white people? And so she hung out with her brothers, with the black people, and that began the process of saying, okay, this is a community that at least accepts me. I want to be part of this community. Does that make any sense to you?
It does, and I don't have a problem with that. I have a lot of white friends who've grown up. I'm from New Orleans,
uh-huh.
One of the most racially mixed places you're ever going to go to in your life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I have a lot of white friends that I went to school with that felt much more comfortable in the black community, but it was very clear they were white.
Right.
As I move, I live in Charlotte, a very white city. I work with white people. I work with Indian people. I work with people of different backgrounds, but I am very clear and very proud of who I am and where I came from.
There you go.
There's no ambiguity about that.
Right.
That was upon her to be clear and proud.
So her crime in your eyes was trying to pass as black, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Because if she had just said, hey, I want to hang out with black folks and be part of the black community, but I'm a white woman, that would have worked differently. Well, Yvonne, thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, back with more of your calls and thoughts, and right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Let's see here. Lynn in Muskegon, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Lynn, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks, Tom. Yes, I am a 60-year-old waitress, and not one of my coworkers know how we got into the Iraq War. They don't know the difference between Shia and Sunni. We have got to educate the public on what happened during our, quote, shock and awe, where we killed 6,000 people and created this mess. And we fired the military. Nobody had a job, and we continued to kill over 30,000 people, and we wonder why they're mad at us.
Mm.
For every person we kill, we create 10 more enemies.
Yeah.
And the first thing we have to do is acknowledge what happened. And Lindsey Graham, standing up there putting Obama and Hillary down because they want to negotiate and make America look weak, I just want to explode when I hear him.
Yeah, yeah. It is rather distressing to hear these chicken hawks who have never been in combat and seen the horrors of it and so casually want to just send our troops off and not even there's that, you know, the kind of human aspect to it, but then there's also the foreign policy aspect to it. War is by definition the failure of diplomacy. But for Lindsey Graham, he doesn't even want to try diplomacy. He just wants to go right to war, which says to me that there's something scrambled in his brain.
I agree. Well, no, he just wants to make money for the contractors. They don't make any money unless there's a war.
Yeah, yeah. It may well be, particularly since the Supreme Court has said that, you know, any industry can own any politician. It may well be that Lindsey Graham is wholly owned by the defense industry, in quotes, the war industry. And John McCain, of course, we know has been for a long, long time. They get a lot of their money from them. So amazing stuff. Lynn, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, you had a question about disfiguring money, the stamp?
Yeah, is that okay?
Yes. Yes, it is
okay.
Perfectly legal. You can only the law against disfiguring money is really sort of an anti-counterfeiting law. If you render money, if you took a $5 bill and bleached it out and turned it into a $20 bill, that's called disfiguring. It's also called counterfeiting. That's a crime.
If you make the money essentially unusable, if you shred it or something, that's a crime. Yeah. So, you know, if you tore the bill into quarters or something like that, or you covered it with bubble gum or whatever, you know, and then tried to pass it off, tried to use it, that would be a crime. But stamping a dollar bill or a $100 bill for that matter with a stamp that says not to be used for bribing politicians, Ben Cohen has good lawyers, and they have looked into this. And it is absolutely not illegal. In fact, it's a strategy that has been used a number of times in other campaigns. So it's, you know, the stamp is just fine. And go ahead and stamp all your money. I do. So, Howard, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Okay, let's continue the conversation here. Michael in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
You know, if you pull up her record working in the NAACP.
Rachel Dolezal?
She's like spot on with her stances on issues concerning black folk.
Right.
And... you know, if you want to soldier up with us, for us, I welcome you.
Okay? Yeah, but I get that. But if you try to pretend that you're black, is that breaking some sort of taboo?
You can be whoever you want to freaking be.
Okay.
And. You know, that hierarchy, that vertical hierarchy that you stated earlier, white man, white woman, black man, black woman.
Right.
It's really white man, white woman. Then you put every minority in between and then.
Oh, Asians, Hispanics, and then black men and black women.
Yes, because they get the honorary white card, okay?
Yeah.
And then it's black. Then you can put blacks and black men, black women, and some Native Americans hate black people. And I've heard incredible venom come from Native Americans, but you can put them on the same line,
right?
At the bottom,
right?
But all the, you know, when every other, black gays are at the bottom, because even black people have issues with black gays, okay?
Right.
And they're in our churches, they're in our families, they've been a part of us, but it's amazing. We'll say they can't get no civil rights, you know.
Right.
You know, I'm like, yeah, okay. When I was a kid growing up in Montgomery County, Maryland, I heard from the white side, you ain't one of them. But then I heard on the black side, you ain't black, you know, and all of us light-skinned people, we have to prove our blackness.
Right.
We got to prove it, okay, because, and then you've heard this cliche, everybody your color ain't your kind. I've seen some Sambo sellout dark-skinned black folk that almost white. They're white. Their whole mentality is anti-black.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah, you see them on Fox News.
Yes. Yes. It's incredible. And it's
but they're being well paid. I mean, at least they're being well paid.
No,
you can...
These are ordinary friends of mine that are getting paid. This is just how they blame black.
do you think, Michael, that that's Stockholm Syndrome, where you start to identify with your oppressor?
Yes, because there's a sister named Dr. Leary. She's a clinical psychologist, and she studied PTSD.
Right.
And she applied PTSD, and she found that in black people, she's created PTSS. And it's post-traumatic slavery syndrome.
Right.
Because all the things that apply to PTSD apply to black folk PTSS. And it's still, it's in our DNA. And we haven't had any therapy going through that trauma from 1619 to 1865. And then somebody coming out on the porch of a plantation and saying, you free.
Right.
What's free? What the hell is free?
Right.
You know, I don't know what free is, you know, but that whole, we haven't had any therapy sessions of deprogramming and reprogramming. I call it, I'm going to be totally honest with you. I call it a niggification process.
Yeah.
Okay. We've been through that, and you took a bunch of Africans who were civilized, had cultures, and you brought them over here and you didn't educate them, and you just dehumanized them for however, what's that, 245 years of chattel slavery.
Yeah, yeah, basically then, broke them like breaking a horse, you know?
Oh, my God. And then you come out and want them to be citizens and normal people when all the other immigrant groups come over here and they get to go to public school, they get to get an education, they get to even work with
right. So on the issue of Rachel Dolezal, Michael, you're saying that if she wants to call herself black and identify with the black community, you don't have a problem with that? Do I correctly understand you?
Yeah, because I guess if you did your DNA, they say we're all African. We're all from Tanzania. We're all from Lupi.
You're right.
You know, that would be something to swab your cheek. And see what's in your what would it say? It probably wouldn't be all European.
No, it wouldn't be because my mother's family's been in North America since the 1600s. I know that there's Indian, you know, Native American blood in me, but I beyond that, I don't know if there's African American blood. Could be.
Yeah, and you know that I forgot that brother up in Harvard that does the lineage thing. He says mostly every black person tries to claim some Native American. But then when he does their lineage and does their DNA, they don't have none.
Yeah.
And so many of us try to, oh yeah, my hair, you know, my soul, my great 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 aunt was Native American. Yes. Come on.
Yeah.
It's not even in your DNA.
Yeah. Michael, thank you for your contribution to the conversation. It's a fascinating one, and we will continue it throughout the day. We'll be back. It is coming up on the top of the hour here. We are going to have a short debate at the beginning of the next hour with Jeff Steyer, who's going to try to tell us that President Obama should not be banning trans fats. It should be entertaining. And then we'll get back to this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Jeff Steyer, the Director of Risk Analysis at the conservative think tank, the National Center for Public Policy Research. Nationalcenter.org is the website. Jeff, you've been on our program before, right?
Many times.
Yeah, welcome back. So the president today may be banning trans fats. Trans fats are fats that have been heated up and had hydrogen bubbled through them actually there's a variety of ways to form them. That's the most common intentional one. So that they become essentially inert. At least in some ways, they can last on the shelf. This is why Twinkies would live forever. But what we've discovered over the last few decades is that, you know, 5,000-10,000 people a year are dying of heart attacks because of trans fats. And you're opposed to his doing this, and I don't understand why.
Well, not necessarily. The facts are not necessarily like you're laying them out. The reason we have trans fats being used throughout the foods, had been using trans fats throughout the food supply, was because an activist group, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, rang the bells against saturated fat, butter. They didn't want us using butter. Butter was going to kill everyone. We have to replace it. It's a public health emergency, argued the Center for Science and the Public Interest 20 or so years ago. So we listened to them, and we had to come up with a way of replacing saturated fat, which has specific purposes. It's more shelf-stable. It does all sorts of things that you can't do from regular cooking oil for many causes, for many purposes. For instance, in crackers, it gives you more of a shelf life. So we replaced the so-called dangerous saturated fat at the behest of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, one of the leading food police groups. We replaced that fat with trans fats because you couldn't just put in olive oil, the healthier olive oil, instead. So we did that at the behest of these groups, and now they allege that this fat acts a lot like, or maybe slightly worse, than the saturated fat that it replaced. So what do you do? Well, in circumstances where food scientists were able to replace the trans fat with another cooking oil, they did so. And as a result, through the private sector, consumption of trans fats fell off a cliff, Tom.
Because they had bad press. So the argument you're making then, Jeff, is not, it sounds to me like the argument you're making is that the government should not be involved in this. We should leave it up to the marketplace, that if people know that trans fats can kill them, they won't buy them. They won't buy products that use them.
I give you a more nuanced answer to that question, which is, and I salute the Center for Science and the Public Interest for raising concern and getting labels on trans fats. Now we know how much trans fats.
So you're in favor of government intervention requiring labeling?
I think education is appropriate under limited circumstances.
Do you think GMOs should be labeled?
Well, I don't think GMOs are dangerous in the way that high levels of consumption of trans fats
You're selective in your.
I think we ought to. I use the science to guide us. I think we ought to do different things based on different levels of harm. So if something's really dangerous, like trans fats at high levels, then maybe we ought to have a warning label. See if that works. If the warning label brings down consumption to levels that don't present any significant risk, as we've already done.
But if the president can, basically what I'm hearing you say, Jeff, is that getting rid of trans fats is going to, with some foods that still use them, is going to make it harder for, it's going to make those foods slightly more expensive, or it's going to make their shelf life somewhere between a little and a lot less long, okay? These are the concerns of industry. Frankly, I don't give a rat's ass about industry. I'm concerned about the American people. And if 5,000 or 10,000 people are going to die this year from eating trans fats in our food supply, it seems to me incumbent on we the people, on the government, to say, no, you big corporations can't put that in our food anymore.
I know you don't like big corporations, but I think you need to understand that there's more to it than that. First of all, I would quarrel with the 5,000 number, and we can get to that. But when I debated Michael Jacobson from the Center for Science and the Public Interest on a different show earlier this morning, he expressed concern that if we replace trans fat with, say, palm oil, which is one of the possible replacements, there could be unintended consequences.
The main one is deforestation.
So many people are concerned that Malaysian palm oil is the use of Malaysian palm oil could have some unintended consequences, particularly deforestation. So you can't just say, let's get rid of trans fats and switch to a replacement like palm oil because there are unintended consequences. You have to think it through.
Well, no, we should ban palm oil that's being imported from countries that are illegally clearing jungles, natural rainforests and jungles. To plant these palm tree plantations. I mean, that expose has been done, and it's a huge contributor to global warming and it's destroying biodiversity. But
so
there's a lot of other oils out there. This is a problem for industry to deal with within the constraints of the rules that we the people set for the food industry. You want to be in the food industry?
We're setting those rules now, but let me just educate you a bit. We use the industry uses trans fats for specific purposes. I'm interested in public health. I'm interested in free markets. So I know you're with me halfway. From a public health perspective,
I'm interested in free markets. There, in general, I mean, but literally, there is no such thing as a free market.
Fair enough.
There is no such thing. Markets are created by governments.
Fair enough.
From the currency used to the rules of the road to the court systems used to enforce them. I can't run my business without government setting the rules, and neither can you.
But you're right. But as we set these rules, we ought to do it with constraints based on science. And my concern is that if we ban trans fats for the very few uses that they're still being used for, which are cases where replacements are hard to find, have very high unintended consequences, may cost a lot more, we're only using trans fats today in a little bit of food, and the harm from that is not established. The 5,000 number, I don't know even where they could come up with that. It's not based on any current data, because we don't have current data, because numbers have gone down.
But if trans fat is bad for you, you're not denying that. Why not simply say no?
Because then you could say the same again about sugar. Sugar is bad for you if you consume too much of it. Salt is bad for you if you consume too much of it. Trans fat is not a health food, Tom.
Sugar and salt are not artificially created ingredients by the food industry.
Whoever created them doesn't matter.
These exclusively exist. Jeff, the point is these exclusively exist in processed foods.
Do you think sugar it just grows naturally and we have all of it because it's natural? No, sugar is cultivated, it's processed, and it's unhealthy if you consume too much of it.
It is not an artificially created compound. Trans fats are.
Well, our bodies can't really tell the difference whether it's natural or it's, there are lots of things that are
natural. That's why this stuff is poisonous.
No, it's not. It's poisonous at high levels because it acts a lot like butter. In fact, because of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, we replaced butter with trans fat, because it acts a lot the same way. Now they're finding out that it acts a lot the same way in terms of how it affects our body, which is too much is harmful. Essentially, you could argue we ought to ban butter because too much of it is harmful. There's nothing about butter that's safe because it's natural. We process it. Man makes butter. It doesn't come right out of the cow in butter form, right? Right, Tom?
No, but it has not been heated up to 794 degrees and had hydrogen bubble through it.
No. The reason that the trans fats are heated up and they put hydrogen in it is to make that vegetable oil behave a lot like a saturated fat.
Yeah, I know. That's what I said in the very beginning of this conversation.
So why would you suggest that two fats that act very similarly, one being synthetic, one being natural?
Because the trans fats are so much more potent than saturated fats. I mean, I think, you know, everybody should be a vegan, frankly, but that, you know, not get the butter either, but I don't think the government should be enforcing that. But we're not talking about a natural compound like butter. We're talking about a chemically created compound used exclusively by the processed food industry. And frankly, I have no love for them.
That's clear, but I'm glad you believe in some role of limited government, that the government shouldn't enforce veganism. That's a start.
No, as I said, I don't think the government should. Oh, I see. You're acknowledging that. Okay. Jeff Steyer, Director of Risk Analysis of the National Center for Public Policy Research, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your calls and some more thoughts about everything from Rachel to the TPP to Hillary Clinton. Well, stick around. And welcome back. Rich watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Oh, not a whole lot. I just wanted to call on this whole racial thing. It breaks my heart. I can't understand why we can't learn to love one another. We need so much to work together. There's so many more important issues than us hating because we look a little different. It goes back, I think, even before Rome, where if you could keep people fighting on all these other little issues, we're getting robbed by the old moldy white guys.
Yeah.
And getting cleaned out, and they're killing our world.
So you're suggesting that this is part of the bread and circus of the media, that instead of talking about how, the Jamie Dimon or Lloyd Blankfein or these guys on Wall Street are basically ripping us off, it's easier for us to talk.
Keep mongering going.
Yeah, yeah.
They keep the violence.
Well, that was essentially Nixon's Southern strategy. You know, was reach out to the white Southern racists, who at that time in the late 60s were largely Democrats, and convert them to the Republican Party. And it was very, very successful. And the Republican Party continues to do that. They continue to reach out to the racist vote.
Well, I can't understand it, though. It just, I don't know. There's a lot of things in this world that don't make sense to me. I mean, I look at my little girl. I raised her around people to call people people. And I've got a friend that he's a true Rastafari, and he's got property in Jamaica and everything. She doesn't know him as a black man. She says he's the guy with blue hair because he's got long gray dreadlocks.
Right.
And it's like,
is he a white guy or a black guy?
He's black.
Uh-huh.
You'd be like, if you took a picture of what your typical Rastafarian would look like from Jamaica, he could be a poster child.
Right. Okay.
He's probably 70 some years old, and she doesn't know him as that. She doesn't know him as all this.
I'm guessing, Rich, that your daughter does at some level. The difference is that this younger generation coming up is less likely to notice that racial difference and then act on it in a way that harms people of the other races.
Yeah, I suppose you're right on that one. But I
which is really racism.
Why
I mean, that's,
we all realize we all need to pull together. Really need to pull together because there's serious, serious things going on in our world today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think the issue of race is actually one of the serious things that's going on. I mean, you know, black people are being killed by police. Black people are being denied economic opportunities. Black people are being locked out in many cases of you know, housing opportunities, job opportunities. There's,
and it's,
you know,
wrong.
It's
straight
it's,
up
oh, of
wrong.
Course.
You're just as good as you or I or anybody else.
But it's
We're
still going on.
We all have such an important part to play and a role in this world.
Yeah, but it's still going on, and I think that this I think this actually is a very important issue because it raises the question of, you know, what is race? Where does it begin and where does it end? What you know, or where does one race begin and another end? In fact, I'll tell a story right after the break that I think is kind of interesting about that. Rich, thanks for the call. I salute your hope for a non-racial society, but I'm telling you, that's part of white privilege. The idea that it's even possible, I think you'd get a very different response from an African American, although I can't speak for any. But anyhow, we'll be back. Welcome back. I want to tell you just a little story that, I'm not sure how relevant this is to the Rachel Dolezal story, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And it's like the reporters now are hunting her. I'm watching this on TV. It's like she's resigned from the NAACP. One of the people who taught me a lot about white privilege was Andy Shalal. Andy is he lives here in Washington, D.C. He started and owns the Bus Boys and Poets restaurants. And he's a brilliant guy. Very, very smart. And a decent human being. He ran for mayor of D.C. in the last election. And you know, he didn't win, but you know, we had him on the TV program. We tried to promote his candidacy. Good guy. And Andy and I were talking on the air. You can find the clip of this. It's on our TV show from about, what, 2-3 years ago, whenever the last election for mayor in D.C. was. And he was talking about how he came to the United States from Iraq. He's an Iraqi immigrant. So he's Middle Eastern. And his skin is fairly kind of in between light and dark. And so he said, he told me the story. He said that when he first got here, some of the black people that he knew, and he opened this restaurant, which is, you know, it was originally opened in the U Street corridor right around from Ben's Chili Bowl. I mean, this is a black, a historic black neighborhood. and he opens a restaurant, and there's pictures of all the civil rights leaders all over the place. And so everybody just assumed he was black. And in fact, he told me on the air, he said, you know, he said, somebody asked me once if I was high yellow. And he said, I'd never heard that phrase. I had never heard that phrase either. But apparently it's a phrase used within the black community to describe somebody who is so light-skinned that they could perhaps pass as not being African-American. But they assume, but the assumption was that he was African-American. And he was actually Iraqi. He also, I mean, here's, I said Andy taught me so much about white privilege. He trains his wait staff. He said, you know, there actually is a difference in the life experience of white and black people that informs how they will respond to you as a waiter or waitress, depending on how you behave. He said, for example, if the restaurant is three quarters empty and a white couple comes in, they will probably feel most well treated if you put them in a corner by themselves. But if a black couple comes in and you put them in that corner by themselves, they will feel like they've been disrespected, like they've been pushed out of the mainstream. So you want to sit them, you know, not next door to, but in proximity of everybody else. And I noticed it was just a funny story. I took the Amtrak home, the 9 p.m. Amtrak. I think it's the last Acela train. Home from New York Friday night after doing my TV show there from the Talkers Convention. And this whole train car, Acela is more expensive than the regional, so, you know, it's not as full. And they both run every hour. The regional is a four-hour trip. The Acela is a three-hour trip. And I was willing to pay the extra for the faster ride. I wanted to get home by midnight. And it was a good thing I did. And so anyhow, I'm sitting in this train car, and there are two of us in the train car. As they were boarding in New York, there was a white couple that was about eight seats back behind me, and I was pretty much right in the middle of the car, in my seat, on the right hand side of the aisle. And a black woman came in, and she sat right opposite me, in the same aisle. The entire car is empty. And it immediately caused me to think of what Andy had said to me of, you know, of that story that he tells his waiters and waitresses. Now, again, you know, I'm a clueless white guy who's like figuring this stuff out as I go along through life. But the situation with Rachel, I mean, it seems to me that her crime was lying about her family, you know, saying that one of her parents was black, saying that her adopted child was actually her biological child. If she got a scholarship at Howard by saying that she was black, that actually is, I believe, a crime. It's certainly a moral crime. Working for the NAACP, the NAACP hires white people as well. But, you know, what do we do with this whole racial identity thing in the United States? And how do we, okay, here's the white privilege speech, right? The privileged white guys will say, how do we just get past it all and be like Stephen Colbert used to say, I don't see race. Right. Well, that's white privilege. But what do we do with this? And what should be done with Rachel? Or what should she do? I mean, now that she's been outed, this has to be devastating to her. And yet, she was telling these lies. And lies that may, in fact, have been destructive. But I think it's beginning an interesting national conversation on where race begins and ends. Okay, number one. Number two, did you see Hillary Clinton's speech on Saturday? I was not terribly, I wasn't knocked over by it, but I thought she did a reasonably good job. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Does this make you more inclined to vote for Hillary Clinton? We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with your calls right after the break. Welcome back. Rachel Dolezal has, if I'm saying her name right, has issued a statement on Facebook, on her Facebook page today. She said, I have waited in deference while others expressed their feelings, beliefs, confusions, and even conclusions, absent the full story. I am consistently committed to empowering marginalized voices and believe that many individuals have been heard in the last hours and days that would not otherwise have had a platform to weigh in on this important discussion. In the eye of this current storm, I can see that a separation of family and organizational outcomes is in the best interest of the NAACP. This is basically her saying she's resigning from the NAACP. Just for what it's worth, her parents came out and said, you know, she's our kid and she's white and we're from Czechoslovakia and Germany or something like that. But that doesn't mean that there's not, you know, African-American or African-African blood in their gene. I mean, there's been genetic intermixing and again, this in Europe as well as everywhere else. But anyhow, she says, while challenging the construct of race is at the core of evolving human consciousness, we cannot, in caps, we cannot afford to lose sight of the five game changers: criminal justice and public safety, health and health care, education, economic sustainability, and voting rights and political representation that affect millions, often with life or death outcome. The movement is larger than a moment in time or a single person's story. She said one's racial identity. Oh, I'm sorry. The NAACP said one's racial identity is not a qualifying criteria or disqualifying standard for NAACP leadership. And the Washington Conference of the NAACP said that they stand united behind, or stand behind Ms. Dolezal's advocacy record. In other words, she did a good job. And then back to what she said, this is her statement. Please know I will never stop fighting for human rights and will do everything in my power to help and assist, whether it means stepping up or stepping down, because this is not about me. It's about justice. It's a very complex situation. Or is it? Or is it just, you know, a really simple thing of a woman telling lies about who she is? Audrey, in Richardson Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's, thank you for letting me be on your show again. I have a question. I have questions here. I'm bewildered by what she's done. I'm not offended by the fact that she worked at the NAACP. I mean, as you stated, I think a couple of times in your show, that there have been people of various races, creeds, and colors that have been employed by NAACP. Like, there were very people who started it.
Right.
I'm not offended by the fact that she taught African American studies. I am bewildered by the fact, and slightly offended by the fact that she, you know, usually when you do the process of passing, it's a member of a traditionally and historically marginalized group passing him or herself off as a member of a traditionally privileged group.
Correct.
And she's done the reverse here, and I have questioned why. I have a hard time trusting what her motivation might be, because usually when that happens, it's to gain some sort of advantage. She might very well be very sincere about, you know, trying to sympathize with African Americans and what we've been through. But at the same time, you know, you're talking to somebody, I'm an African American woman. Does she have any idea what it's like in my personal life to be told by both a black man and a white man, you know, hey, my ex-husband told me he, you know, he actually meant to at least marry either a light-skinned black woman or a white woman at one point in time when we were having a disagreement. I've been told by a white man when I was dating sometime after the divorce, my family says I can't marry a black woman. We're supposed to just play around with them, and then when we're done playing around, you dump them and marry a white woman. Has she any idea what that feels like? Does she know what it's like to have experienced discrimination when you're qualified for a otherwise qualified for a job, but then you're not only told to that the person they've hired instead of you is more qualified than you are, and then on the next breath they ask you to train that person in your skills.
Right.
You know, and so it's like, you know, does she know what it's like to, you know, have your children are perceived as cheap just because you're perceived as cheap because you're a black woman? Does she know what it's like to have to compete as a working class African-American single mom against disgusting, despicable messages that have been poisoning our music for the last 25 years about the N-word and all the mess, the plantation mentality saturated and socially regressive lyrics
right.
that have been used to communicate and use and abuse that word, that slur? You know, does she know that slur was created to objectivize us? Perhaps she knows that, but does she know what it's like to be expected, you know, to deal with sellouts and, quite frankly, coons amongst their own people? You know, it's just a very, like you said, it's a very complicated issue, and that's why it's extremely bewildering. Like, why would you do this? I mean, you're also talking to somebody, I'm aware of the history, like the set-aside program in various parts of the country where you had situations where there was a, I don't know why they decided to add white women as being qualified for such programs, but, you know, they did. And you've also had circumstances in which you've had a business that was primarily managed and operated by white men, but they used a white woman as a figurehead so they could get the contracts that were set aside for minority groups. You know, this
right.
is supposed to be an opportunity to, you know, balance the scales, and, you know, you have that kind of stuff going on. There, and here, I think in, like, the Chicagoland area, I think they actually stopped those set-aside programs because of the corruption that was taking place, and it was hard to, you know,
right.
try to stop it.
Well,
Where is she coming from?
Well, this is something that I think I was kind of exploring in the first hour, is that what if, I mean, you know, she grew up in a family with two black siblings, adopted African-American kids who her parents adopted, and she ultimately adopted one of them from her parents, and she married a black man. And so it's you know, I was pointing out this piece in the New York Times about Caitlyn Jenner and this feminist, this woman, fairly famous feminist, was saying, you know, Caitlyn Jenner can call herself a woman, but she does not know what it's like to grow up a woman and, you know, be dissed by the boys and be freaked out with your first menstrual period and be denied job opportunities and things like that. So, you know, let's acknowledge that she's trans. She's not a woman. And but I think that transracial is bizarre. I don't find, you know, but on the other hand, I mean, what, I don't know. It's, well, my where I was going with that is, you know, if she grew up as a child hanging out with her black brothers, siblings, and being marginalized by white kids in school, who can be brutal, as you know. I mean, children can be the most brutal. Maybe that was when she began to identify, to say, okay, my, you know, the white people are not accepting me. I'm going to start hanging out with black people. What do you think? Audrey? No, Audrey's gone. Okay. Hopefully. Wait. Oh, okay. Oh, she might have been on mute. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I, you know, this conversation is very interesting about race, and I think it's very important. But I wanted to talk about gentrification and social class. I think that is safe to say that it's and race may enter into it also, but. You know, this is a process that's been going on, and it's really has had a detrimental effect on communities. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, just because somebody has some money and finds a neighborhood desirable for whatever reason, and comes into that neighborhood, they feel like they have a right over the community because they have the money to, you know, do whatever they want with this property. They don't.
Well, DC has, you know, I've actually been in some of the community meetings down in the Southwest, and they're pushing these developers really hard to have a certain percentage of affordable housing and things like that. But the fact of the matter is it's still gentrification. You know, it's just a softer form of it.
And, you know, if you look at it historically, like, for instance, North Beach in San Francisco or Greenwich Village in New York, you know, these were places where people could make art and they could afford to live. They could get their little job at Safeway and afford to do all those things and maybe even go over, you know, to Berkeley and go to school and do all of these kinds of things. And, you know, those, you know, hotbeds of culture and art don't exist anymore.
Right, and that's not even racial gentrification. That's basically white community to white community. It's just the prices going up.
And,
the rich people are coming in.
We're the poor for it. And in this
although Harlem is starting to experience gentrification now, too.
Yeah,
when Bill Clinton moved in.
Yeah, Harlem used to be in the 20s and 30s. It was a neighborhood that had all of what I was just talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, in New York City, that is so hard. I've talked to artists recently that came and visited here.
They're all moving out to Brooklyn. Yeah, John, I got to run, but thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls right after this. Welcome back. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, welcome to the program. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hello, Tom. As a spoiler alert, everybody has black blood in them.
Because all humans began as Africans.
Yeah, we started in the Euphrates Valley.
Yeah. Well, we started in Tanzania.
And if you go by the conservative formula, if you have one drop of black blood in you, then you have to write you're African American.
Right.
So what's the big uproar?
Well, Corky, these are the kind of things that white people say. You know, the principal benefit of white privilege is that you don't walk around thinking, I'm white. How's that going to affect my day? How's that going to affect my job? How's that going to affect my relationships? How's that going to affect my friendships? How's that going to affect my opportunity in life? You know, that's the biggest benefit of white privilege. Bill O'Reilly never even has to think about his race. And yet he denies that white privilege exists, which is just like stupid.
Yeah, right.
You know? But that, you know, you're a white guy. I'm a white guy. It's easy for white guys to sit around and say, oh, can't we just all love each other? Why don't we just set all this stuff aside? That's not the experience that black people have in this country. That's even a possibility in their lifetimes.
Well, I'm Irish American. My dad told me it. We were just African Americans turned inside out.
But see, you're right. There was enormous discrimination against Irish Americans in the United States after the Great Migration from the potato famine in the 1850s. There was terrible discrimination for about two generations until the 1880s or 1890s. Basically, they got stuck in ghettos in largely Boston, and the only job they could get was as a police officer, which back then was a very undesirable job, thus coppers and the Irish cop and all that kind of stuff. I get all that. But see, an Irish person, a second generation Irish person, no longer has that Irish accent, and they can pass as a WASP, as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I mean, they could pass into the larger white society and no longer experience that discrimination. And whereas a person whose skin is a different color doesn't have that option. You know, the closest they can get to that is to pick up the speech patterns and dressing behaviors and things like that of the larger white culture by and large, and hope to be accepted into it and have some success in it. And, you know, increasingly that's available and happening, but it's, there's always that, you know, the skin color is always there. And this is the thing that white people don't get. I just, you know, it's just, I'm not trying to call you clueless here, Corky. What I'm saying is that I think what you're saying is what most, white people who have, a good heart, but have never had the experience of being black or being in the midst of a black community for a long period of time and seeing what it's like to be black, would say, because the reality is we're not Rodney King, can't we all just live together? Well, maybe not. I mean, there's still a mind-boggling amount of racism in the white community in this country. And then you get people like Pat Buchanan writing books about, more brown children are being born than white children. It's the end of American society and culture. Come on. Corky, thank you for the call. Ten minutes before the hour. Boy, a fascinating and hot topic. A lot of people calling in, and we will get back to your calls. In fact, I'm going to commit the next hour to them. But first, I want to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org, and find out what's going on in the world. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria. Welcome.
Hey, Tom. Well, I'll just scrap it from my list of topics, because I know you've already covered the fact that Rachel Dolezal has stepped aside.
Yes.
As president of the Spokane NAACP.
Right.
So, done that.
Okay.
Okay.
Scratch it off your list. Yeah, we've been talking about it for an hour and a half.
Scratch it. Right. Okay. So, President Obama, according to White House spokesman Josh Earnest in the White House press briefing, which I've just stepped down from into the basement of the White House where I am right now in our booth, says that President Obama is confident that the White House will navigate the, quote, procedural snafu, unquote, on their unfortunate trade vote last week and get it across the finish line. That, of course, was the disastrous trade vote on Friday, trade votes, in which they failed in the first trade vote and then were successful, from the White House's point of view, in a second trade vote, but it didn't matter because the two were in tandem, and if you failed in the first vote, then you failed in the second vote. And all this goes together because the president wants the ability to be able to negotiate trade deals without having to come back to Congress every 5 minutes and say, may I please do this, may I please do that?
Right.
So that he can go forward and negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
But Nancy Pelosi also said, and I'm not sure when, I read this in a piece in Huffington Post this morning, that, but I trust the veracity of it, that if Republicans wanted to, this is my paraphrasing,
right,
essentially, that if Republicans wanted to sweeten the pot, for example, with a transportation bill, in other words, let us, throw a couple billion dollars at our infrastructure and creating jobs and putting our roads and bridges back together, then they might get their trade deal. And that just made me cringe. I mean, this is a political bargaining chip. I see this as a matter of principle. But I'm very concerned that, they're going to have this vote tomorrow, and that between now and tomorrow that the Republicans will have figured out a way to sweeten the pot, and maybe not legislatively. All they've got to find is enough Democrats who will take an Eric Cantor kind of deal. Yeah, go ahead. Or a Billy Towson kind of deal. Probably a better example. Billy Towson pushed through Medicare Part D and then, boom, walked right into a $2 million a year job at Pharma. At the trade organization.
Well, it's 80 or 90 Democrats they've got to get. I mean, that's an awful lot of sweeteners or horses' heads on the
But we're talking about trillions of dollars here.
Right.
So, and hundreds of billions of dollars in profits that will be created by the lockdowns that are in this legislation. And this is just the beginning, by the way. We know of three of these trade bills now. And the third one, the trade and services agreement, that could blow up the net neutrality. It could do... I mean, it could block banking regulation. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible. And all this stuff is coming down the road if Fast Track gets approved. So what do you think is going to happen?
I think it's going to be quite difficult for them to muster the votes either on the Republican side, which I don't think they are going to do, or on the Democratic side by tomorrow. I just don't think that they're going to be able to do it by tomorrow. Now, the majority leader, Kevin McCarthy, in the House, says Congress must find a way to pass President Obama's trade agenda. He says there's no obvious pathway. He told reporters today there are many different options to revive the trade package, but he didn't make any predictions about how or when they might proceed.
Yeah.
So, one option is to send it back to the Senate, but that's very dicey. They are saying they want to get it done this June. I'm not sure it's going to be as quick as tomorrow.
No, in all probability, they would do it on a Friday afternoon or maybe Friday at 10 p.m. so that it completely misses the weekday news cycle. And, the weekend comes along and something will come, some story will come along and people will never even notice. I mean, the Senate voted this down once and then it came back and they voted it up, right?
Right. But I think they'll do it the minute they think they've got the votes and before they think anybody can change anybody's mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's when they'll do it. That second. If it's a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday morning.
The other thing that was really astonishing to me is the number of foreign governments that are throwing millions of dollars into lobbying on this thing. You know, Tom Daschle, he's lobbying on behalf of Japan for the TPP, for this. And, you know, he's taking big money, big bucks from the Japanese government for this.
This is very important to an awful lot of countries.
It is. And they're buying former American legislators and having them lobby their colleagues and presumably, you know, pass out campaign dollars or PAC dollars or God only knows what all. This is like, you know, the cancer stage of oligarchy. Anyway, what else is going on in the world?
There is a hearing tomorrow before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee at which Office of Personnel Management officials are supposed to testify about the massive hack of federal employees, current, former, and possibly government contractors, which is somewhere between 4 million and 14 million individuals.
Wow.
So apparently, according to Jason Chaffetz, who's the Republican chair of that committee, he says that the White House Office of Personnel Management officials are refusing to testify or at least, quote, being very resistant to agree to attend. He's prepared to get a subpoena if need be to get them there. I asked Josh Earnest today about this and what the White House position was on them testifying. He pretty much equivocated on this. And sort of said it, left it up to them, which I thought was interesting, and I pushed him on this. He said there had been a lot of briefings on the Hill at which they could testify, and at which Congress could be briefed, which I thought was a little.
What is OMB hiding?
Well, OPM. Well,
it, or OPM.
Precisely.
Yeah, that's the question. That's the $64,000 question.
Precisely. We'll know more tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
It's always great to see you. Thank you. Happy Monday. Yeah. We'll be back. We will be back with your calls on Rachel Dolezal, Hillary Clinton. I have a whole bunch of Hillary Clinton clips here, and more right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a couple of real quick things, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here as promised. The first is that the TPP is going to come before the House of Representatives again. It's actually going to be the TPA and the TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, and then the Trade Promotion Authority, which is basically fast track and a program to put $700 million into a pot to pay for the education of all these Americans who are going to lose their jobs as a result of the TPP. In other words, they're already telling us we're going to lose American jobs. And the Republicans wanted to take $700 million out of Medicare and use that to send people to presumably private for-profit colleges, you know, so that they can get some degree in something that'll be totally useless and they'll end up flipping burgers. This is nuts. So who were the Democrats who voted for this last week? Who you need to call if one of these people represents you. The number for Congress is 202-225-3121. This is TPA. Yeah, I know, but it's all right. This is the Trade Promotion Authority. These are the ones who voted yes on the Trade Promotion Authority, which is basically Fast Track. These guys all voted yes on Fast Track. Ashford, Barra, Beyer, Blumenauer, Bonamici, Himes, Hinosa, E.B. Johnson, Kilmer, Polis, Quigley, Rice, Schrader, Connolly, Cooper, Costa, Cuellar, Davis in California, Delaney, DelBene, Farr, Kind, Larson, Meeks, O'Rourke, Peters, Sewell, and Wasserman Schultz. So you may want to, you know, if any of those people happen to represent you, you may want to give them a call. Secondly, over the weekend, Hillary Clinton announced her, you know, I guess she's already officially announced that she's running for president, but there was that Mercury retrograde period in between. Mercury went direct on Thursday, and so, you know, I'm just noticing this, right? Ronald Reagan would not sign anything when Mercury was retrograde. His wife wouldn't let him. There was the Reagan White House was just, you know, when Mercury was retrograde, things shut down. And it seems to me that, you know, other people are noticing that. Mercury is direct now. It's over. It went direct on Thursday, 2 days after my boat went down. It didn't go down, but, I mean, the electrical system went nuts. But anyhow, I just let's play clip number four. I think this is a nice one. Hillary had a lot of good things to say in her speech, and as I've said many times, if she is the party's nominee, I will enthusiastically support her and vote for her. Here's the clip.
Prosperity can't be just for CEOs and hedge fund managers. Democracy can't be just for billionaires and corporations. Prosperity and democracy are part of your basic bargain, too.
There you go. And I you know, yes. Meanwhile, the Morning Consult poll of New Hampshire found that right now Hillary Clinton is polling at 42% and Bernie Sanders is polling at 32%, which is pretty astonishing. And I just got a letter from Bernie. I mean, I'm on his mailing list. Everybody is. This went out to anybody who's gone over to BernieSanders.com and signed up. He says, Thomas. Right. This is how I know it's not really from Bernie to me. One of the biggest mistakes President Obama made once he was in office was after mobilizing millions of Americans during his brilliant 2008 campaign to basically tell those supporters, thank you. Now I'm going to sit down with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and take it from here. I will not make that mistake. What we're building together as part of this campaign is not just about electing a president. No one person, not me or the best president you can imagine, can make the changes we need by him or herself. What's necessary to make change happen is a mobilized grassroots movement. That's especially true when a few wealthy billionaires and corporations have their sights set on buying our elections. So, anyhow, BernieSanders.com, HillaryClinton.com, I'm assuming, for Hillary Clinton. Yeah, okay. Or both. I mean, I'm fine with either one. I have a preference for Bernie, but I'm fine with either one. Jeb Bush has launched his campaign today. He's taking the word Bush, though, out of his logo. I wonder why. It just says Jeb, and there's an exclamation point. And then, you know, over at DU, somebody replaced the period on the exclamation mark with a picture of W's face. Good one. Okay. And then there's Rachel Dolezal, who we've been talking about, and I want to get back to that as well. A lot of people want to talk about this. So Eileen in Bowling Green, Ohio. Hey, Eileen, thank you for calling in. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got 2 points I want to make about Miss Dolezal. I believe that she disguised herself to protect herself from white backlash. Considering her background, which you talked about a little bit there, you know, she's pretty much marginalized in both communities.
Right.
But I think she took on her identity or borrowed this identity in order to, as I said, it's pretty rough, I mean, to find the protection the African-American community. Then the second point that I wanted to make, because, you know, and I have sympathy for her in that respect. However, there are a series, there are a lot of websites out there that are particularly directed toward African-American women. And as you know, black women are like on the, we really get disparaged because of our appearance, particularly our hair. And so there's a movement that's going on, that's sort of a revival of the black hair movement. I was a part of it when it was back in the 60s. These kids aren't really doing anything new.
You're talking about the going natural Afro thing?
Yeah, the Afro,
yeah.
Right. And the basis of that, we are always criticized about our kinky hair. So if you will notice, there are a lot of black women, such as myself, that are sporting our hair naturally, the way that it is, as a way of saying, here we are, we accept ourselves, and you're going to have to accept us on our terms. Miss Dollazal has shown up on these websites, and she's done selfies where she claims that her hair is naturally kinky. This is particularly an issue, particularly with professional black women, whether you're going to wear braids, whether you're going to have your afro out, because it intimidates black, white people.
Yeah.
So I was through with her when she began to represent herself as that. That's a lie.
Yeah.
That is not her natural appearance. And I just might say she looks better as a black person than she does as a white person. But that kind
Eileen, you just raised two really important things. First, you know, if she looks better as a black person than as a white person, then did she gain status by going from being a, to use your phrase, you know, a not so good looking white person to being a very good looking black person? I mean, did she actually in some way find herself elevating in status? And then your first comment about survival, that really resonates. I mean, are you saying that you think that maybe she was just, you know, like just trying to make it through life and this was the way that she found she could do it?
I managed the pressure was pretty rough. I have a number of students who are white and they've grown up in black neighborhoods. And just as there was a story earlier about that, living between those two worlds.
Right.
And I'm sure my perception is that the pressure is pretty tough. Now, she had a support system. She had a black husband. She had black children. She had a community. So she just really just decided, in my opinion, to go with that, even though it was definitely a deception.
Right.
But claiming to be, you know, the politics of black hair, and particularly what black women are subjected to, we see white women imitating everything that we are, the full lips, the big hips, you know, we're seeing,
yeah.
What is Miss Kardashian that's getting off because of
yeah.
But, you know, and all of these are appropriated from black women, but yet we don't appear.
Yeah.
We're not elevated. We're not cherished.
Right. I got it. Eileen, thank you. Thank you for a very, very thoughtful comment. Several of them. Thank you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up, Michael?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay. What this Rachel Dollazal story has brought to my mind is religion. In America, Jesus is depicted to us as a white man when he was actually a dark-skinned Palestinian Jewish man who preached love and acceptance, while it seems today that a lot of people today just want to keep ridiculous, trivial differences as the point of their argument. What do you think, Tom? Thanks.
Well, the latter part, I agree with everything you said. It's interesting that we as a society have tolerated and in fact even embraced the whitening of Jesus. I mean, that's a whole another, you know, conversation. And obviously it started when Europe adopted Christianity and then they had to reinvent it in ways that were acceptable to Europeans, which, you know, included things like the Yule log and the Christmas tree. These were all pagan traditions that you know went back 10,000 years in Europe. The fertility ritual of killing rabbits and spreading their blood on the fields and eating eggs, so you'd have a good harvest. We turned into Christmas and Easter. So part of that Europeanization of Christianity was to turn Jesus from a Middle Eastern Jew into a white European Christian. And then, you know, that came to the United States. You would think that by now we've had, you know, enough research done and enough information available, enough knowledge about these things to be able to say, you know, isn't it time that we started darkening Jesus in our churches, in our literature, in our pictures, in our depictions, and white people get over it? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I agree, but reinvent is a great word. You're right, Tom, and I'll just end it there because I know you got calls, but
okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Good to hear from you. The reinvention of Jesus has been a very, very interesting one. Jill in Princeton, Minnesota. Hey, Jill, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say thanks to Danielle and Shano and everybody else last week. They did a fabulous job.
Great. Thank you.
I'm acknowledging white privilege, and in my neck of the woods, there aren't very many other people rather than Caucasians, but my niece-in-law is a beautiful woman who is white. She is African-American, and she's Native American, and in my small way of acknowledging white privilege, I broached the idea to her, and wow, did I get educated from her experiences.
Mm.
So I do believe that grassroots types of things really make a difference on an individual basis.
In other words, we need to be talking to each other about race, particularly those of us who are of different races than the persons we're talking to.
Well, yes, and in the case of my niece, I could very well tell not very many people bring this up to her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like race is a topic, almost a taboo topic, at least on a one-to-one interpersonal level. And Jill, thank you for the call. It's like, you know, one time Joe Madison was here in the studio. I said, what is it that white people don't understand about the experience of black people in this country? And Joe said, everything. And apparently he was right. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jay in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Oh, Tom, hi. Thanks so much. I love your show.
Thank you.
I especially love that we're exploring so many angles to this story, and I think that in many ways that's the key, and I kind of want to, you know, I have so much compassion and empathy for both Rachel and Hillary, since that's the subject. I'd like to see you do a forum, for example, on white male privilege, because
yeah.
I think a lot of people want Hillary to be like Bernie. They want her to be open. They want her to be, you know, just more candid,
mm-hmm.
Supposedly speaking more from the heart. She can't be that way. We don't have as women role models to be the president of the United States. She has completely different challenges to deal with.
Well, also, I don't think that we've had a president who was a real straight shooter in terms of talking to the American people since FDR, or maybe Harry Truman.
And that's true, too, because nothing is black and white, and I think that that's the key to all of this. I mean, if we can find, as human beings, the point of contact to anybody, whether they're black, white, Hispanic, whether they're, you know, transgender, homosexual, heterosexual, all of it. It's all fluid.
Yeah.
We are using 10% of our brains. We don't...
Well, that's actually a myth, Jay. That's actually a myth. We use all of our brains.
Well, we probably use some parts of all of our brain. I don't know. I'm not going to discuss that with you, but I know that many theories are that we only use 10%. I know one thing.
Yeah.
We're in an evolutionary crunch.
Yes.
And a lot of us are all over the place trying to find solutions. And I think one of the solutions is to remain open-minded.
Yeah.
and just open-minded to all ideas like you explore on your amazing radio show.
Well, thank you.
You're metaphysical. You have a metaphysical background. That's beyond the physical. This woman, Rachel, going back to her, how do we know that she hasn't had a past life, for example, where she was black? I used to counsel hundreds of people. I've had at least 3 women tell me that they thought they were black. And where does that come from?
Yeah.
I mean, they were heartfelt about this subject. They were challenged.
Right.
They were struggling because they didn't fit in.
But CJ, it's sort of like, you know, Corky called in and he said, hey, can't we just all, you know, stop talking about race and live together? And I said to Corky, Corky, you're a white guy. This is how white men who are the most privileged in this society respond, because of course white men don't care about race and or gender for that matter. It's not something that oppresses white men. And I'm guessing that you're white, because
but the point is, as humans, we can make a point of contact. I know this from personal experience.
Sure,
I'm not
sure. But
this from, you know, yes, I have white privilege. I could go into a story how I once realized that, but that's not really important. The main thing is we have to remember that we're humans.
Yeah.
That we're in an evolutionary crunch.
Okay, Jay. Tough. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. I agree with the sentiment totally. I'm skeptical about this particular moment in time, but I absolutely agree with your sentiment. Thank you for the call, Larry in Lancaster, California. Hey, Larry. Larry. No, Larry. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, I've been listening to your show. I've been calling your show for years, and I think today is the first time I've ever been ticked off at you.
Okay. What did I do?
And I'll explain why. But not to try and judge why Rachel did what she did and why she did it. That's not what I'm ticked off at. What I'm ticked off is this right here. You will get chastised, and when I'm not talking about you, I'm just talking about people in general. If you go somewhere in public or on airwaves or whatever, and you call Bruce Jenner a him instead of not using her,
right,
you will get chastised for that right now.
You're correct. You're right.
But with when a white woman pretends to be a black woman, you brung up a mental issue. So basically, as a black person, what you're saying to me and what I'm hearing through my black ears is that Bruce Jenner can go have a surgery and surgically remove the parts of him that make him a male and turn him into a female and have chemicals put in his body that make him more feminine and more female. He's okay. That's all right, because that's his choice. But if you dare to want to be black in America, you have a mental problem. You have to be crazy to want to be black. But it's okay for this man to have surgery and want to be a woman instead of this woman putting on makeup and fixing her hair a certain way.
So you're suggesting, Carl, that the gender and race are not that different, that if somebody wants to change their race to be transracial, that's okay?
Well, what I'm suggesting is be consistent.
Be consistent.
If you're gonna say that a person that wants to change their gender, that's their choice and it's not a mental issue.
Yeah, I got it.
You can't then say that if a person wants to identify with another race.
Hang on.
To the Tom Hartman program, call 202-536-2370.
Carl, for the record, I said this is one of many possibilities. I'm not calling her crazy, and my apologies if it came across that way. Carl, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Apropos of Carl's call, and I'm really sorry that we didn't have longer to talk. It's the unfortunate thing of having hard breaks in a radio show, because I would have liked to continue the conversation with you. But I was thinking, and again, clueless white guy here, I often get these things wrong, but I was thinking about like that Chris Rock HBO special where he talks about, you know, even the white guy who's in a wheelchair because he's a paraplegic and he's working as a janitor would not trade places with me because I'm black and I'm even a rich black guy. I mean, you know, to say it without all the expletives. And, you know, basically talking about the power of white privilege in our society. And so the question is, why would someone give up white privilege and go from, well, you know, why would they do that? And I present it as one of the possibilities that the one I suggested was borderline personality disorder, which is not, I mean, it's in the DSM, so I guess you could call it a mental illness, but really what it is people who are uncertain of their own identities. And it's usually the consequence of a traumatic childhood. And this woman certainly had a traumatic childhood. So I'm not saying that, you know, you'd have to be crazy to want to be black. But Chris Rock is saying that. And I don't know. Anyway, it's Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Robert, what's up?
How are you doing today, Tom?
Good.
Good. Well, I just wanted to correct that one caller that said that Jesus was a Palestinian. Well, that's not historically true. He was actually a Hebrew. He was a Jew.
Right.
But anyway, back to the racial thing here.
In an area that was then called Palestine, was it not?
Right, but that didn't make him who he was because of where he was.
I understand.
Just like where we are in America today.
Yeah.
We are all together here. All of this racial stuff is because of the government throughout history. Let's all think about it. Even the media that they put on, different programs from radio to TV, Ozzy and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, Good Times, all these shows, they all showed either one race to be stupid and then again another race to be stupid. Now, this is all corporate TV, and it's been going on for years.
Well, I think over the time, you know, television has reflected our society as well as driving it to a certain extent. And I think Norman Lear was actually, he and I had this conversation on our TV program a while ago, was actually the first, he made the first TV program, and I think it was the Jeffersons, about a middle-class black family who weren't, you know, doing the stereotypical stuff that white filmmakers and TV producers had always had black people doing. And, you know, and that was seen as shocking at the time, you know, holy cow.
Right.
And, but it was very successful and it led to things like, you know, the Huxtables and, you know, all the, you know, these other programs that characterize black people as essentially the same as white people, just different color skin. You know, with the same, in other words, the same in terms of, you know, problems within the families and, you know, in relationships and work and all that. I mean, obviously there's more to it than that. But Robert, I get what you're saying. I'm just saying over and over again, I'm going to keep saying the white people who call in say, hey, can't we get past this? I'm not hearing that from the black people calling in. Cindy in North Glen, and maybe I will. I don't know. But Cindy in North Glen, Colorado. Hey, Cindy.
Hi. I'd kind of like to tie everything in here. You know, you're talking about Rachel, and from the way it sounded, from what she said on Facebook, she sounded, I assume she was very, very, very committed to the NAACP and doing a really good job. I mean, this was something
she did.
It's something that's deep inside of her. You know, whether, I don't know why her parents would essentially sabotage something like that.
They're actually in a lawsuit right now, Cindy. She and her parents are estranged.
Really?
She refuses to refer to them as her parents, and there's a lawsuit between the two of them. I don't know the details of it. but it's a messy situation, which again may have to do with the kinds of stresses that she grew up with and lives with. That you know, I armchair psychoanalysis is always a dangerous thing.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I'll stop right there.
Totally, totally subjective, you know. But you can tie a lot of this in. You know, I was while you've been talking about it, I've been watching you just for a little while, and I am totally going to. I want a Bernie Bear. I do Free Speech TV. I want a Bernie Bear. But I've seen in my life a lot of white Indians. White people claiming to be Indians. Okay, now you were talking about it. I know quite a few card-carrying Indians, you know, and they walk around, they have teepees, you know, they have their necklaces, but they don't take the action. So there's motivation and action. So if she's making this decision to go ahead and present herself this way, the thing is she's taken big action, and she was making strides. I don't know what, you know, her job experience, and, you know, maybe that's something that could be looked into, is what has this woman accomplished in this position?
She helped build that NAACP chapter. She did very well by them, according to the news reports. There's a nice piece in The Guardian about it. Yeah, she and the state NAACP and the state of Washington acknowledges that and says, you know, yeah, she did a great job for us. So, but I get your analogy. I know I know quote white Indians. I one of them is an acquaintance of mine. He's got maybe 10 or 15% Indian blood, but he wants to identify as an Indian. He doesn't look like an Indian, a Native American, but he dresses like one. And he goes to the Sundance, and he does the ceremonies, and he's adopted the religion. And but he couldn't. He tried to get a tribal card, but he didn't have enough Indian blood in him to get that tribal card. I have another friend who's Native American, who is genuinely Native American, does have the tribal card, and, you know, is an author and has been on this program a number of times, in fact, who could pass as a white guy. But also you could look at him and say, well, yeah, he could be an Indian too. So yeah, we're all, you know, kind of mixed up in all this stuff. And again, you know, given how badly oppressed Native Americans are in America, you know, why would white people want to become Native Americans? You know, that's a complex question with complex answers. Cindy, thank you for the call. David in San Diego. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I remember, and I'm sure you do too, Mike Douglas TV show where this black man brought his child about 7 or 8 years old with a golf club who was going to grow up to be the best golfer in the world. And that black guy was Tiger Woods' dad. That little kid was Tiger Woods. And he grew up to become the greatest golfer in the world. But in the same token, he denied his father right in front of whole America. He denied his African-American name.
Because his mother was Thai, wasn't she? She was Asian, as I recall.
Filipino, yeah. Thai, Filipino, something of that nature. But I know his father stood up for his son. I remember
it.
And I don't remember we did not dissect his choice as we are dissecting this young lady's choice. I also remember as a child, white kids being adopted by, or fostered by black mothers in my community,
mm-hmm.
who grew up as in a black family, who I'm sure now are passing as white, but their souls and their spirits are black.
Right.
I can imagine, and I would like to ask the community to take it easy on this lady. And as you had already just mentioned, that she's done great things, but to embrace a culture that we have a lot of people rejecting is a big deal. I mean, this is definitely open for the type of discussions that we're having. But to me, it sounds that she's been true to that side of herself that she's embraced. by going to a HBCU, by taking black history classes, by becoming a professor at a college in black history, by developing the NAACP. I don't know that that is a bad thing at all, as a matter of fact. So we should hold back a little bit and find out what's really going on with this young lady. She probably can wind up doing more good than she is harm.
Well, I think she has, David, and it seems that the people who are critical of her and, you know, the criticism is when she explicitly lied or, you know, exploited the woman who called about the hair products thing. That particularly got my attention. I didn't know about that. But, you know, she shouldn't have to lie. I don't know. It's a tough one. David, thank you for the call. We're out of time. We'll
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Annie in Boise, Idaho, watching Free Speech TV on cable. Hey, Annie, what's up?
Hi, yes, sir. I think that you could not have a better coalescing of issues that affect African Americans and women than the issue of what is getting injected into our babies. I would like to give a shout out to all of your female and African American listeners to please take in Tony Muhammad's speech on June 9th. He stood on the Capitol steps of Stanford or of Sacramento and gave this most moving and compelling speech in opposition to SB 277, the California bill being proposed by Dr. Richard Pan and Ben Allen to remove parental exemption rights for their children to go to school. So
for vaccine. So you're basically you're calling to say that your issue is that parents shouldn't be forced to vaccinate their kids, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Cool. I got it, Annie. Thank you. Thank you very much, Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Tom. I went to graduate school at a very diverse college where there were many African Americans and Latinos, and I really had to learn to listen to stories for a long period of time. Because my first reaction was to speak. But I found that was, at least in my experience, was counterproductive. I found that I needed to listen because I didn't really know the stories of necessarily people and their experiences.
Right.
And I found that to be like a great way of learning. And so I try to do that now with a lot of people, just to listen, because I think people, they have a great need to tell their story about their stories about their lives. And I would applaud you for bringing up this subject today, because I think it's a great subject that needs to be talked about. And you can see that people really have strong emotions about this.
Yeah, and it opens this whole spectrum of stuff around race in America. And I think the more we discuss race in America, at least from, you know, in a non-Limbaugh way, you know, the better.
Right.
But yeah. So by listening to other people's stories, are you talking about, you know, what you mean is that we need to listen to Rachel, let her tell her story, and before anybody goes and starts judging her?
You know, I would like that to happen, because I've seen some comments that are, you know, kind of for and against. And I go, well, this woman's story may be somewhat complex, and people can have their own opinions, obviously, about, you know, what she's done.
But if race is a social construct, which is, I think, widely accepted now in the scientific community, it's not a genetic thing, although there are genes for individual things like hair color and you know, eyes and skin color. But there's not a specific gene that makes a person black or makes a person white. We're talking thousands of them. So there's no gene for race. We're mixable. We're all variable. We're all mongrels at some level. Then No, I don't know where I'm going with that. Alan, and I just got interrupted by my own music. Alan, thank you for your call. Thanks for the thoughtful call. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, don't forget, Jeb Bush claims he's Hispanic. Maybe because he has a Mexican wife. So.
Yeah, that's right. He listed Hispanic on some application or registration. Voter registration.
Voter registration, yeah, which is interesting because he lived in Mexico for some time and he married a Mexican wife. So maybe that had something to do with it.
So Jeb Bush is doing the same kind of thing that Rachel, what's her name, is doing.
Yeah, I never can remember her last name. Yeah, exactly. But what I wanted I heard a caller suggest, and I think you repeated it, that she had gotten some sort of affirmative action scholarship to go to Howard.
Yeah, I said I thought that she did not. I had not seen that, but one of our callers called and said, yes, she did, and I don't know what the truth is, frankly. Do you?
Yeah, I don't think it's true. From what I understand, it's not true that she was white, you know.
Yeah. She presented herself as white when she went to Howard University.
White at that time.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be careful about that because there are a lot of people, but white people, who think that somehow it is an advantage to be black.
Right.
And
that's the Rush Limbaugh shtick.
Right. They would use this as an example. See, because she was black, when she pretended to be black, she was able to get a scholarship.
In fact, I'll bet that's the conversation that Limbaugh is having on his show right now as we're speaking.
Right. And it's not true anyway, but either way.
Right. Right. Good point.
So,
excellent point.
You need to be careful about that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Anita, thank you. I'm so glad you called and said that. Kevin in New Orleans. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, man, fantastic, as usual, your shows.
Thank you.
I just want to say, man, look, we have to start being real about this. The bottom line is this. As much as we know, based on our human capabilities right now, we all came from Africa.
Yep.
Okay. Now, this concept of black and white is a political construct.
Hey, Kevin, you're breaking. Kevin? You're breaking up really badly. If you're walking or moving your phone around or something, if you could just pause and say that sentence again, because I could not hear what you said. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm going to get you off of my earbud and put you on my phone directly.
Oh, that's a good idea. If you're using Bluetooth, that's the problem.
Is this at all better?
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so tell me again what you were saying.
We have to be honest about this. We act like we're not evolved at all, okay? First of all, the best we know, we all came from Africa. Human being, and that's the operative, human being came from Africa. So the best we know today, it may change tomorrow.
Right. We are the human race. Yes.
That of the human race. Now, the next thing is we have to be real about, okay, there is no such thing as white and black. That's a construct, political construct, devised and perpetrated by white supremacists for the purpose of having advantage, for whatever reason. I don't exactly know why, or why it started.
Well, I'd say, you know, slavery and colonialism is probably where it started, but back to you.
Right, right. So we really need to start talking in real terms. There is no such thing as white and black. We talk about this. We might well be talking about Bunny and Roadrunner.
Yeah, but try and tell that to the Klan.
Right. Well, no. I'm not saying the consequences of behavior is not relevant to decisions that basically sociopaths are making, because that's a sociopathic process. White supremacy is a sociopathic process. What it does is it hurts all of human race, because what you do is you eliminate the potential for benefiting from the genius of another human being for something that's arbitrary and artificial.
You're right.
Which is race.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay? You're absolutely right. And
we all
Go ahead.
We all suffer from that sociopathic behavior that someone started a long time ago for, because of some political reason that they couldn't compete. And essentially, who suffers for it is all human beings.
Yep.
Even whites, if you don't fit the profile. And most whites don't fit the profile of the privileged people who are benefiting from racism. Most white people don't even benefit from that, quite frankly. They're victims of that same sociopathic behavior, because if they don't have black or people, well, I'm going to say black, but non-white, I'm going to call it non-white. And if you really want to know what I'm talking about, there's a guy called Neely Fuller Jr. who talks about this, okay? Mm. And he's the most prolific mind I've ever seen. I've listened to a lot of people, okay?
Yeah.
Now I'm a little more optimistic than him, but he's dead on point when it comes to that concept of black and white and how it affects as far as white supremacy is concerned. And I'm not saying all whites are necessarily have that prejudice in them, but because they're white, and like you said, say that to the Klan. The bottom line is you have the potential for benefiting from that concept of white supremacy.
Kevin, all white people benefit, or the vast majority of white people benefit from white privilege at some even relatively small level, and most of them are unaware of it.
And I don't want to condemn all white people, because guess what? Bald people in every category somehow have favorite status, even with black. You know, the bottom line is you got a certain skin color in certain communities. You have, or if you have a certain socioeconomic class, you have a certain benefit. Look at Clarence Thomas, for instance. He's three shades of midnight, darker than midnight. And he might as well be the Grand Ku Klux Klan as far as most blacks.
Well, look at what he voted to do to the Civil Rights Bill. I mean, you know, it's, yeah. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. Thank you to everybody for your calls. It's been a fascinating conversation today. And we'll see where this goes. We'll see where this goes. Don't forget, number one, the TPP is supposed to come up for a vote tomorrow. Now is the time, 202-225-3121, to call your member of the House of Representatives and say no. And number two, tag, you're it. Start dialing. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.